been an excellent session this afternoon. Talked about love and various definitions of love that deal with affection. And then we talked about spirit, soul, and body, whole health. Thank you, Jim, for a really inspiring presentation. And then our third presentation of this session is on empathy. By Reverend Dr. Victoria Campbell. Victoria has a PhD in chemistry from the University of Texas, Austin, and a PhD in theology from the London School of Theology. And you'll see what her various specialties are in this presentation.
Okay. All right, thank you so much. Today I'd like to talk about empathy as God's providential care in the midst of pain. So one of the good places to start is with the question of pain is, it's often posed, why would a loving God allow pain as a part of this creation? And as you may have friends or colleagues or kids that ask this very question, and it's often an obstacle to faith. So one way theologians have tried to answer it is to treat pain as punishment for sin, or pain as the work of demonic forces. But I'd like today to consider the possibility that pain has a beneficial and intended purpose in God's good creation. So we can ask, well, couldn't we do without pain? Why is it there? And so what we look at, when we look at the science, we see that it reveals the biological purpose of pain, that pain is a protective mechanism of the body. But how should we think about this? So for example, when we get, an ordinary person gets a blister on the foot, they will limp and protect that injured area. But on the other hand, a leper who can no longer feel pain because of a biological, a bacterial infection, they will walk on that foot until it's infected and the bone fragments begin to become discharged out of the foot, and often they don't even realize they have an infection until the smell is strong enough that they notice it. Okay. Another way we can also see that pain is necessary is because with congenital insensitivity to pain, in young children, we find that children are born with congenital insensitivity to pain are incapable of feeling pain and often die in the first few years of life because they injure themselves relentlessly, often falling victim to deadly infections. So the science suggests that the biological purpose of pain is to increase the longevity of the creature, to make them live longer. The Judeo-Christian faith suggests that the teleological purpose of pain is to nurture the interdependent, self-giving, empathetic relationships that God asks for. So let's consider the two greatest commandments. You'll find this in the New Testament, but you'll also see this in the Old Testament, and that they are to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. So we can see that the ethics of the Bible tells us that human beings are supposed to look out for each other and show empathetic love, and we find that empathetic love decreases pain. So what is pain and how is it perceived? So I'd like to talk about that a little bit today. According to the International Association for the Study of Pain, there are two components to pain. There is it's actually the activation of two different parts of your brain which are perceived simultaneously as one experience. And so one part of it is the sensory aspect and the other part is the distressing aspect. So the sensory aspect of pain, if I can get you all to participate, if you can just take your hand, put it on the top back part of your head, that is the parietal region, but specifically the part in this image that you can see is we're covering the somatosensory cortex in the insula. Okay, that's in what is known as the reptilian brain. I might call that the parietal region of the back half, but that's what I'm referring to. And that part tells us the variety and the location of pain. It tells us if we have a burn on our hand or a cut on our knee or a blister on our foot. It tells us the variety and the location. In contrast, the distressing aspect of pain is found in the frontal lobe, which is the newer, more highly evolved mammalian brain. And if you will now participate with me one more time, if you will take your hand and just line it up, approximately put your palm about where your hairline would start, and then put it straight back. Yeah, we're not going to go there. All right, that is the anterior cingulate cortex. And just the top part of it, the dorsal part, is the part that is the most associated with pain perception. And actually, this is a very important region because this region activates the psychological distress for both injured tissues or injured relationships. So this is where physical pain and social pain overlap in the brain. And so it will, if you're in a MRI, it will activate that same region whether you have a broken leg or a broken heart. You've lost your job or you have got cancer diagnosis. Okay, so there's another part. This is also important because it has the highest number of opioid receptors in this region, which will be significant in a bit. But the distressing aspect of pain is gives both the emotional and that psychological response to pain that that's our response to tissue damage. So that's where you might have crying, you might have fear, you might have anger. But we will see that this child, and you can see in the picture, can be comforted by its mother, father, or friend through empathy. In other words, the physical pain can be comforted by social pain. And that's where we get the opioid release that will then go into that frontal lobe that we had just talked about. So going back to just that main idea, is that pain, to be called pain, there must be not only the sensory aspect, the locational information, but there must be a distressing aspect, which is the psychological aspect of pain, okay? It requires both. So if there's no pain, if you've taken morphine, that's why we say she's no longer in pain, okay? There's no longer the psychological distressing aspect. So a logical question would be, which species perceive pain? According to the U.S. Academy, National Academy of Sciences report, Recognition and Alleviation of Pain in Laboratory Animals, the evidence for pain perception is only strong in mammals and birds. And I strongly recommend reading this report if you're interested in this. But they go on to explain that invertebrates, they respond to noxious stimuli through nociception. Okay, nociception is an involuntary response intended to protect the tissues, but it involves no psychologically distressing aspects. So if you've ever got an electric shock in the laboratory, which I have at some point, or if you have ever burned your finger on the stove, you might have noticed that you have a jerk response. That is from the tip of your finger to the spine, and it goes back through a muscular contraction that is not involving the brain. It goes, I think, about 300 meters per second. But then there's a secondary response that then goes up the spinal column to that frontal lobe that tells you, oh my gosh, my finger, and it hurts like crazy, okay? That is a separate response. So nociception is just the spinal response. So we see that in invertebrates. For fish, amphibians, reptiles, they respond with nociception and the parietal part of the brain, the back, but without the psychological distress. So I'm not going to go any further into that description, but I talk about it in my book. It's been published by Cambridge University Press, The Problem of Animal Pain. So going on, the reason that those the reptiles, amphibians, and the invertebrates do not have pain perception is because they do not have the frontal lobe. In birds, birds have a telencephalic region that is the equivalent to what the mammal has. But that the reptiles, amphibians, and fish do not produce the psychologically distressing aspect of pain. So we could see that if you don't have the psychological aspect of it, then you cannot have pain. So what is the purpose of pain, and why would a loving God allow it? So before moving on to empathy, let's draw some conclusions about pain. The pain region of the brain activates in mammals and birds to warn both damaged tissues and damaged relationships, so that would be social or physical pain. Pain is actually a survival advantage for long-lived intelligent species who can learn from pain and pleasure. Moreover, humans without pain perception die prematurely from conditions like leprosy and congenital analgesia. So, when we are told in scripture, love your neighbor as yourself, we see that not only in human beings, but mammals and birds are also social creatures that release opioids through positive social interactions. Humans, mammals, and birds each ease each other's pain through the brain opioid theory of social attachment. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. The brain opioid theory of social attachment is our response to pain, whether it's physical or it's social, it's soothed by loving interactions. And that's where we have the release of endogenous opioids in the ACC. That is endogenous, that's the native ones in your own brain. And this is learned in childhood from caregiver-infant interactions. So in other words, we are developmentally hardwired to receive pain relief from others. And this is something that might be expected from the God who asks us to love one another. Amen. So this is also why physical touch, eye contact, and human interaction is especially important in the earliest stages of development, and it creates connections in the neural hardwiring of the growing brain between loving human beings and the child, and it relates the interaction with pain relief, okay? And we see this in mammals and birds as well. If you look at the images on the screen with the parent infant peer relationship, you can see in observational studies, they see mammals and birds also learn to be comforted and soothed by their caregivers and experience pleasure and peace in this way during infancy. If these infants, human or non-human, do not experience healthy, lasting relationships with their caregivers, they will be more susceptible to anxiety, depression, and PTSD later on in life. So to explain how empathy works, we have to start talking about the mirror neuron and mentalizing systems. So pain can be mitigated by positive social interactions. This pain relief through the brain opioid theory of social attachment is enabled by two important brain systems, which we're going to talk about. So the mirror neuron system tells you what is the other person doing. This baby is not just stretching her mouth. What is she doing? She is yawning. That's right. You all have a mirror neuron system, and that helps you figure out what the other person is doing. But your mentalizing system helps you figure out why they're doing it. Why is she doing it? Because she's sleepy. She is tired. And so the mentalizing system enables us to understand the other person's motivations, why they're doing what they're doing. All right, so together these things enable our empathy and our empathetic motivation. And empathy allows humans to share and understand the mental and emotional states of others. So in empathy, the mirror neuron system makes the observer's face imitate the facial expression of others. It causes the observer to experience those emotions themselves. So one of the interesting things is actually they found that people that get Botox have a harder time recognizing the emotions of others. When you have that thing where they show you picture after picture, what's the emotion? The Botox people can't do it because normally our face automatically responds and on a microscopic level matches, because of the mirror neuron system, what they're doing. And that way we each get a tiny taste of what they're feeling. And that's how we can name it. Well, because if our face is frozen, we can't do that. All right. So when we show the empathy and we match that sufferer that sees that our face is laughing with them when they laugh, and mourning with those who mourn, okay? It actually, they feel understood and comforted, and it helps release those opioids. Okay, so the person receiving the empathy, they get those endogenous opioids. It reduces their pain, whether it's social pain from a broken heart or it's physical pain from an injury. It helps feel us safe and cared for. But God doesn't just bless the person receiving this love. God's order blesses the giver of empathy. It turns out that they found that the person giving empathy, it reduces their cortisol, which is that stress hormone that if we don't, we often have too much of it, you know, it causes high blood pressure, it can cause weight gain, all sorts of other health problems. It's reduced when we give empathy. Our dopamine processes are modified. It causes the release of oxytocin. Oxytocin is also one of those chemicals that help others even in difficult circumstances, like when there's blood, there's vomit, there's danger, we will still step forward and help the other person. And so it creates the empathetic motivation to help the other person even under difficult or distressing circumstances. And we have to realize that empathy is also shared among animals and birds as well. So we see in nature that after a fight, ravens will comfort the distressed losers or offering beak to, they'll do that by offering beak-to-beak nudging and friendly preening. So whereas human beings would usually talk to one another to comfort one another, this is how birds do it. For elephants, distressed Asian elephants comfort one another with vocal communications and direct physical contact. Chimpanzees console each other in times of distress by hugging and kissing. And I have some more examples, but they're hard to get pictures of, so you will just have to use your imagination here. But so for example, more examples of animals helping friends, dolphins have been seen saving companions by biting through harpoon lines and pulling them out of nets when they've been tangled up in them. A blind elephant was observed being led around by her seeing eye friend elephant to lead just a normal life. In rats, when faced with the choice of obtaining chocolate chips or freeing a trapped fellow rat, the test rat usually frees the other rat, so don't be a rat. But then I also want to point out that sometimes, you know, you hear about Hamilton's inclusion fitness, you have to have interrelatedness. Oh, well, empathy isn't real, they're only helping because they're genetically related, right? But the thing is, we also observe interspecies empathy in animals. So you see humpback whales have been observed protecting seals and even baby gray whales from being attacked or eaten by orcas. You see dolphins who, there was a case in Florida where a dog who had fallen off of the canal into the water was in the water for 15 hours, was cold and exhausted, but the dolphins not only kept him up and were taking care of him, but they raised such a ruckus of noise that could be heard a half a mile away, and the neighbors finally came to investigate and rescue the dog. So the dog survived. And then also dolphins saved the life of a surfer in 2007 who had been attacked by a great white shark. And they had continued to fight off the shark and protected this surfer until he could get to shore and he survived. So I guess the thought I would like to leave you today, okay, so I'm just gonna conclude with a connecting the science with faith before our last thoughts, but pain is biologically necessary for long-lived intelligent creatures to survive. Empathetic love reduces the distressing aspect of the sufferer's pain and blesses the empathizer. More highly evolved creatures appear to be hardwired to love one another and alleviate one another's pain. So if even the animals show empathetic care to one another, how much more should human beings made in the image of God? And thank you for your very kind attention. That's all right. All right, that's
probably feel more close to you.
I just want to get your reaction to this because
there's a guy named Joe Rigney, who used to be president of John Piper's seminary, who's famous for claiming that empathy is a sin. You shouldn't empathize too much with people who are sinners, I guess. I'm not sure exactly what he's going with. I would just like to get your reaction.
Well, I'm a Wesleyan, so I would say I don't go. I don't know what seminary he went to. Is he a Christian?
Well,
because if he's not even claiming to be a Christian, then that's all right. I think everyone's entitled to their opinion, but I also feel like pain is real. And so his worldview is kind of like pain is real and just suck it up because you shouldn't do anything about it. And people can have that opinion and that's okay. But I just think for those who have chosen voluntarily to follow Christ, then we have a different answer. And it's we are supposed to love the other, even if they're a sinner, which means showing them empathy. And that's where Jesus told us we are not supposed to judge. We are just supposed to love.
Yes. May 31st, 2019, Joel Rigney, The Enticing Sin of Empathy, How Satan Corrupts Through Compassion. Hmm. He was the president of Bethlehem Seminary in Minneapolis.
Okay. Yeah.
Can I land that position real quick? And not that I share that view, but those who often speak against empathy are often doing so in the context of empathy often will get people to act irrationally, and so they will do things that harm the greater group to help maybe one person or something in that those sense. And so it's more of it's leading people to be irrational. And Paul Bloom, secular psychologist, wrote a book against empathy, which isn't really against empathy per se. It's more of a more careful use of empathy, might be a way. And so some evangelicals or conservatives tend to go further stuff, but it's still that idea of empathy pushing us to be irrational.
Well, I think, I kind of wonder, well, what are they saying is rational? And because I don't really, I'd have to see their illustration of it. But my concern there is some people would say it's not rational to help someone that's not your business. Like they would say the Good Samaritan is irrational. Okay, he didn't have to, that's not me.
No, that's
okay, I'm sorry, okay. The angels are speaking. But I would say, why is it not rational? Because I can't benefit from it? That's a very hedonistic, utilitarian worldview. And some people grasp that. But again, that is not the only worldview. And from the Judeo-Christian worldview, it's an unacceptable one. We are called to be the Good Samaritan. We are called to show empathy and love, even when it's not beneficial to ourselves, which some people might call irrational.
Well, that would match utilitarian economic principles that
exactly.
are common in this country.
Okay. Okay, yeah, Janet.
Thank you for all the cute pictures.
Okay.
Yeah,
what I could get.
Yeah,
yeah.
My question is, would it be helpful to distinguish between acute and chronic pain? Because chronic pain simply doesn't seem to serve an adaptive function.
Did you say chronic?
Chronic versus acute to make the distinction. And also, I think there are different neural pathways.
Well, I do talk about the acute, the persistent, and chronic pain in my book. But let me just say here, even with chronic pain, sitting there and being empathetic reduces pain. Because one of the things that's very interesting from the medical literature is that you can have two people with the same cancer, side-by-side rooms, reporting the same levels of pain. But the person that has visitors and other social interactions requires less painkiller than the person that is emotionally isolated, has no one in their life, no visitors, and they are asking for painkiller dosages beyond the legal limit that would kill them because they have so much pain. And the difference is, even though it doesn't end the pain, it mitigates it. It takes the edge off. And the thing is, I worked as a chaplain for a summer, and that's the thing that just shocked me and that led me to this is like, why is it I could go in a room and I don't have to say a word? I don't have to give them a word of a wisdom or like know an answer to solve some intellectual conversation here. And yet at the end, they just said, well, I feel so much better. Thank you for coming. I said nothing, but I didn't realize my face was matching them. I was listening with active listening, and in the process, I was releasing their own medicine into their head. Jim, did you have a question?
I don't know where we're at.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm glad you showed that these emotions are shared by other species. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of the primate study center that Sue Savage Rumbaugh ran for years and years and years with bonobos.
Oh yeah.
And they had a whole socialization structure. An afternoon snack was always looked forward to, right? So there was a little tray, let's say a tray that mm-hmm. that they would pull out to get the snack. Okay, so she showed the one occasion when there was a half banana on each tray, one for Kanji, one for Panbanisha. And they enjoyed the banana, and then the next tray was a small cookie, one for Kanji and one for Panbanisha. And then the third tray was M&Ms. They love M&Ms.
So what's your question?
And
we got two more questions to
and
go.
And so on Kanji's there were six M&Ms. On Panbanisha's there was nothing. And they were totally distressed, emotionally upset, because it was unequal. And finally, after a good 2-3 minutes of this stress and emotional outpouring
did they share the M&Ms?
Do you have a comment? I think we got the
yeah.
So Kanji,
yeah.
Kanji picked up three of his M&Ms
and shared them
and put them on Panbanisha's tray.
Yeah.
So that each
you see that in nature, yes.
Do you have any comment to that?
No, I forget his first name. Duval writes a lot of good material. Yeah. Francis Duval. So, yeah, I would say that's an excellent place if you want to find more material like that.
Jim. Victoria, thanks so much. This is really important and plausible answers you're giving to one of the hardest questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's plausible answers given our anatomy and physiology
mm-hmm.
and psychology. Is there a harder question of why did we have to have that physiology and psychology such that pain could be, could there have been another way?
That is an excellent question. And so this is my own personal answer, and I wrote about this in my thesis, and I hope to write it in another book. But so I think it's this, is that God is love. The first gift of love is free will. God doesn't force us to love him or choose him, okay? So if creation groans until the children of God are revealed, those that love God. If loving God means loving even when it's costly, how could the children of God be revealed in a world without cost?
And pain is
is part of that. But we also have to remember that the Bible doesn't say biological death is the end. That says we lay down one life to take up another. And so really is, we have to reframe it from the whole picture of what the Judeo-Christian faith says, not just a piece,
okay.
If that helps.
This will be it, and then that'll be the last one.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out that by contrast, you're talking about empathy as I see, what are you doing? You're saying to another person, and why are you doing it? That's what releases the empathy. But in people who are on the autism spectrum disorder,
that's not what the slide meant. What I was trying to say is the mirror system helps us understand what they're doing. It's not a question that we're saying out loud and say, give me your answer. Okay.
Yeah, of course. But that is exactly that mechanism is what's often missing.
Oh, in the autistic person.
Oh,
thank you. Yeah.
Disorder, that's exactly what's missing.
See, I didn't know that.
Mm.
I don't know what the research says there. I'm sorry, I don't know.
Oh yeah, but there is autism in the animal world. Yeah, I know people who like animal studies on mice with autism.
There's mouse models.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of autism.
But yeah, my question was, I don't know if you're familiar with Eleanor Stump's Wandering in the Darkness.
Oh, I am familiar with that. I mean, I haven't read it for a long time, but what's your interest in that?
Oh, yeah, it's talking about similar concepts, and she talks a lot about, like, biblical narrative,
mm-hmm.
being able to empathize with the characters, and being able to empathize with God,
mm-hmm.
like, the sacraments, as part of, like, a crucial part of our relationship with God, as part of why we've been created to come. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on
Well, I think, yeah, and I've heard her speak, and she's excellent, but she's also coming more from the philosophical background and the theological that way. And so what I wanted to do as a chemist, you know, help show us, you know, because some people, you know, you kind of need to, with Christian apologetics, you have to start with wherever they're comfortable with. So a lot of people would not be comfortable starting where Stump starts, but they're very comfortable with, well, if you start with neo-Darwinian evolution and you start with the scientific literature, they'll start with you there. And then you could bring the conversation then eventually to then, well, is there a purpose to this? Or why do we do this? Or why does that make more sense than just everything is here by coincidence, by, you know, happenstance, by 50-50 randomness? You know, there's more explanatory power with the Judeo-Christian narrative than with the atheistic in this case.
I don't know about you all, but the first day and a half here, 2 days now, just the focus on our unity, focus on health, focus on breaking down divisiveness and hostilities. Every presentation has done that for me. Three today. Thank you for finishing out.
Thank you very much.
Have a good rest of the day, and we'll see you there this evening.
Thank you. Thanks so much. You
that
have
was
such
fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh.